longer under an exarch. The Pope made no objection to this. He had decided to see Liutprand and the Lombards as co-belligerents in the fight against the Emperor's tyranny, and Liutprand was willing to foster this opinion. The growing alliance between the two men was strengthened when a new exarch appointed by Leo III came from Constantinople. This exarch, a man named Eutychius, landed at Naples. The Ravenna port was now inaccessible, and sent a series of gifts and money bribes to Liutprand, promising more if the Lombard king would help him to assassinate the Pope. Liutprand refused. Instead, he went south to Rome and took control of Byzantine territory just north of Rome, the city of Sutri and the land surrounding it. In 728, he offered to turn the territory over to the control of the church, a gift that became known as the Sutri Donation. It was not, in fact, a donation. Pope Gregory II handed over an enormous payment from the church treasury in exchange, but everyone benefited. Liutprand got back a good deal of the money he had spent attacking Ravenna, and the Pope now had, for the first time, a little kingdom of his own. It was the first extension of papal rule outside the walls of Rome, the first of the papal states. Undeterred by his critics or by his troubles in Italy, in January of 730, the Emperor Leo III issued a formal edict ordering the destruction of icons all across the empire. When the Patriarch Germanus refused to support the edict, Leo deposed him and appointed a replacement. Pope Gregory II died not long afterwards, and his successor, Pope Gregory III, called a church council which met in 731 and excommunicated all the icon destroyers. Leo III, in return, announced that the handful of Byzantine possessions left in Italy were no longer subject to the authority of the Pope. Instead, they fell within the realm of the Patriarch. The eastern and western branches of the church had drawn that much farther apart. Leo III died in 741, leaving behind a legacy of lost lands, shattered icons, and displaced peoples. But the empire was no better off after his death. He was succeeded by his son, Constantine V, 23 and energetic, and even more rabidly iconoclastic than his father. Chapter 48. The Abbasids. Between 724 and 763, the Khazars convert to Judaism, the clan of the Umayyad lose the caliphate, and the new Abbasid caliphs let go of the West. The caliph Yazid II, who had kept the Umayyad Empire from bankruptcy, died after 4 short years with the frontier lands in turmoil. His brother Hisham took over his post and began to bring iron-handed order to the turbulent empire, sending strike forces into Khorasan and Armenia to fight against the rebelling converts, and sending armies against the northern Khazars as well. A triangle of power had emerged in the lands east of the Adriatic. The Byzantine emperor occupied one point of the triangle, the caliph another. At the triangle's tip stood the Khan of the Khazars, Khan Bihar. He had been conquering his way steadily into the surrounding lands, and now his realm stretched from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea, and far up to the north, a massive empire, one of the largest in the world. The Khazars had taken the city of Ardabil out of Arab hands. The Arabs answered by invading Khazar land along the Volga River. The two armies struggled for control of Derbent, the port city that lay on the Caspian coast right between the two empires. Meanwhile, Khan Bihar made a brilliant alliance. In 732, his daughter Tzitzak agreed to be baptized as a Christian, took the name Irene, and married Constantine V of Constantinople. Despite the alliance, the Khazars treasured their independence, something that was made perfectly clear by the Khan's decision, sometime around the middle of the century, that his people would convert to Judaism. There was no mystery about how the Khan discovered Judaism. Plenty of Jews had fled into Khazar land during Leo III's attempts to convert them by force, and Jewish travelers and traders had undoubtedly made their way to Khazar cities long before. But we have to read between the lines to discover his motivations. A 10th-century account remarks that both the Byzantine emperor and the Arab caliph were incensed at the Khan's decision to convert, and a letter written slightly later by one of the Jewish kings of the Khazars elaborates. The king of the Byzantines and the Arabs who had heard of the Khan sent their envoys and ambassadors with great riches and many great presents to the king, as well as some of their wise men, with the object of converting him to their own religion. But the king searched, inquired, and investigated carefully, and brought a priest, a rabbi, and a qadi, a specialist in Islamic law, together, that they might argue about their respective religions. They began to dispute with one another without arriving at any results, until the king said to the Christian priest, "What do you think? Of the religion of the Jews and the Muslims, which is to be preferred?" The priest answered, "The religion of the Israelites is better than that of the Muslims." The king then asked the Qadi, "What do you say? Is the religion of the Israelites or that of the Christians preferable?" The Qadi answered, "The religion of the Israelites is preferable." Upon this the king said, "If this is so, you both have admitted with your own mouths that the religion of the Israelites is better. Wherefore, trusting in the mercies of God and the power of the Almighty, I choose the religion of Israel, that is, the religion of Abraham." Perhaps more to the point, he did not choose the religion of either of his powerful neighbors. Like Dhu Nuwas of Arabia 250 years earlier, he found a path between. By 743, Hisham had tamed the rebellions and invasions in the caliphate, but the victories came at great financial cost, and although Khorasan had been reduced back into order, it was tentative and precarious at best. When Hisham died of diphtheria, the Umayyad Caliphate too began to die. He was succeeded by his nephew, Walid II, an alcoholic poet who was murdered by his cousin in less than a year. The cousin, Yazid III, lasted for 6 months and then grew ill. Just before his death, he named his brother Ibrahim to be his heir, but before Ibrahim could consolidate his power, the general Marwan swept down from Armenia with his army behind him, drove out the opposition. Ibrahim prudently surrendered and joined Marwan's men, and in 744 had himself declared caliph as Marwan II in the mosque at Damascus. He then moved the capital of the Umayyad Caliphate to Harran, closer to his old Armenian territory. He almost succeeded in pulling the empire back together. It had not been under bad leadership for very long, and he had Hisham's 20 years of order to build on. But Constantine V now took the opportunity to attack. While Marwan was still struggling for internal control, Constantine V invaded Syria and inflicted a serious defeat on the Arab navy in a sea battle in 747. The defeats fueled the internal opposition to Marwan's rule. Marwan, like his predecessors, was Umayyad. Since the death of Muhammad's son-in-law Ali back in 661, the caliphate had stayed within the Banu Umayya, the clan of Muhammad's old companion Uthman. The Umayyad caliphs had ruled as Arabs over an Arab empire. For nearly a century, the strongest glue holding the Islamic conquests together had been Arabic culture, the Arabic language, Arab officials in high positions, a bureaucracy supported by the reimposed head tax on non-Arabs. The worship of Allah was, of course, inextricably entwined with Arabic language and Arabic culture, but the Umayyad caliphs were, in the last analysis, politicians more than prophets, soldiers more than worshippers. So when political and military fortunes turned against them, their hold on power fragmented. In the 9 decades since the death of Ali, writes historian Hugh Kennedy, it had become accepted by many discontented Muslims that the problems of the community would never be solved until the lead was taken by a member of the Holy Family, a member of Muhammad's own clan. In the same year as the great naval defeat, Marwan faced both an uprising in Syria and another rebellion in Khorasan. Some of the rebels wanted a descendant of Ali to occupy the caliphate. Since Ali's death, a strong subcurrent within Islam had insisted that only a man of Ali's blood could properly carry on as his successor. The followers of this current, who also believed that a successor of Ali would be spiritually and supernaturally fitted to rule, were known as Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali. Others, willing to cast their net wider, argued that the caliphate should simply go to a member of Muhammad's clan, the Banu Hashim. They were known generally as Hashemites. The revolt in Khorasan soon spread through the entire province, taking it out of Marwan's control. In late 749, the Hashemites gathered in Kufa and elected a member of Muhammad's clan, Abu al-Abbas, as their caliph. Abu al-Abbas could trace his lineage back to Muhammad's uncle, but his election was not unanimous. The Shia rebels had still hoped for a descendant of Ali's and refused to support him. But even without Shia support, Abu al-Abbas was able to gather a sizable rebel army behind him. Marwan II mustered over 100,000 men and marched from his capital of Harran towards Khorasan, meeting Abu al-Abbas and his supporters just east of the Tigris in early 750. The rebel army was fighting for a cause. Marwan's soldiers were largely unwilling recruits, and the Umayyad force was driven back and then scattered. Marwan himself was forced to flee. He went first into Syria and then south into Palestine, and then farther south into Egypt, attempting to raise another fighting force. Meanwhile, Abu al-Abbas sent out scores of men on horseback, their mission to find and kill the remaining Umayyads. Hisham's grandson and the heir apparent to the caliphate, the 20-year-old Abd al-Rahman, was living in Damascus with his family. When word of the defeat reached him, he fled eastward with his brother and a Greek servant, apparently hoping to hide in some small unremarkable village in the old Persian lands. Al-Abbas's men caught them on the banks of the Euphrates. Abd al-Rahman flung himself into the water and began to swim, but his brother hesitated. The soldiers of Al-Abbas beheaded him on the spot and left his body unburied on the shore. But Abd al-Rahman made it to the opposite shore, as did his Greek servant. The two men kept on the move. Apparently they changed course, because they soon arrived in Egypt and then travelled on west through Ifriqiya. Egypt was not safe. Marwan, in Egypt, trying to find an army, was caught sleeping in an Egyptian church in August. Deserted by most of his followers, he threw himself against a band of Abbasid soldiers and was murdered in front of the door. His head was sent back to Al-Abbas, who by this time had earned the nickname Al-Safar, the slaughterer. Al-Abbas, ruling from Kufa as the new center of his caliphate, did his share to make the new Abbasid caliphate secure. He promised that all remaining members of the Umayyad family would be granted amnesty and given back their family property if they would come and swear allegiance to him. A contemporary chronicler tells us what happened. 90 unwary men and women showed up and were seated at a welcome banquet, but before they could eat, Al-Abbas's guards surrounded the banquet hall and killed every single one. The new Abbasid caliph had to deal with attacks on both the far east and far west of his land. The first threat came from the east. For some years, the Tang general Gao Xianji, serving the brilliant emperor Tang Xuanzong, had been leading a slow progression across the Asian plateau, pushing his way almost all the way to the eastern reaches of the Islamic Empire in Sogdiana, just past the Oxus River. The Umayyad caliphs, increasingly weak and disorganized, had not been able to halt this advance. Now an Abbasid army of 100,000 men marched eastward to meet the threat. Gao Xianji had travelled light and far, and his force of 30,000 was no match for the opposition. At the Battle of Talas in 751, the Abbasids defeated the Tang force, ending the Tang attempt to take control of Central Asia. Gao's forces were nearly wiped out, only a few thousand left alive. Without enough men to launch a counterattack, Gao Xianji turned for home. The slaughterer died in 754, and his brother Al-Mansur succeeded him as caliph. Al-Abbas had ruled from Kufa, but Al-Mansur moved the capital to the village of Baghdad. It was a strategic location to build the empire's wealth. Here's the Tigris with nothing between us and China, and on it arrives all that the sea can bring, he told his officers. And there is the Euphrates, on which can arrive anything from Syria and the surrounding areas. He began to build, transforming the tiny town into an imperial capital. The move suggests a new eastward focus, and when another problem arose on the western edge of the caliphate, Al-Mansur did not try very hard to solve it. In 756, the fugitive Umayyad heir, Abd al-Rahman, had arrived in Al-Andalus. He had made his way, over 6 long years, across North Africa to the edges of the last Umayyad province left in the Muslim world. He sent a message to the Umayyad governor of Al-Andalus, Yusuf al-Fihri, announcing that he had arrived to claim Al-Andalus as his rightful territory. The message was not greeted with joy. After the Abbasids had seized power, Yusuf al-Fihri had gone right on governing as an independent Umayyad ruler. He was not pleased to discover that a man with a better claim to Al-Andalus had appeared on the horizon, and he declined to hand the land over to Abd al-Rahman. The two men met in battle just outside Cordoba. Abd al-Rahman was victorious. He defeated and beheaded Yusuf al-Fihri and became the de facto caliph of Al-Andalus. But he did not yet claim the title of caliph. Instead, he took the lesser title of Emir of Cordoba, prince, not king, but still the ruler of the first Muslim kingdom to be entirely independent of the caliphate. In 763, Al-Mansur sent an Abbasid army to Al-Andalus in an attempt to bring it back to the Abbasid Empire. When Abd al-Rahman fought back and defeated it, Al-Mansur decided that it would be wisest to abandon Al-Andalus to the Umayyads in order to keep manpower strong in the east. The Umayyad caliphs had slowly shifted their base of power closer and closer to the Mediterranean Sea, ending up in Syria, closer to the center of the Islamic Empire. But the Abbasids had recentered themselves in the lands that had once been Persia, putting distance between themselves and the western part of the empire. They also grew increasingly autocratic. Al-Mansur, like his brother, began his caliphate with murder. He arranged the assassinations of a number of prominent Shia leaders who had refused to support the Abbasid claim to power. He continued on as he had begun, ruthless and authoritarian, using his network of spies to root out dissent and ordering his enemies beaten, imprisoned, and executed. His intelligence was so frighteningly efficient that he was rumored to have a magic mirror that told him who was loyal and who was planning revolt. The center of Baghdad, which contained his elaborate royal residence, was home to more and more ornate buildings, a whole complex that housed the caliph and all of his family in royal luxury. In the hands of Al-Mansur, the spiritual authority of the caliph took a definite second place to political ambitions, and the Abbasid caliph began to look more and more like an emperor. Chapter 49. Charlemagne. Between 737 and 778, the Pope anoints the King of the Franks. The King of the Franks protects the Pope, and the Iron Crown of the Lombards goes to Charles the Great. In 737, the do-nothing King of the Franks, Theuderic IV, died, and Charles Martel did not bother to appoint another ruler. He was mayor of the palaces of the Franks, Dux et Princeps Francorum, the most prominent Christian warrior in all of the old Roman lands, and he had more power than anyone else in the Western landscape, with the possible exception of the Lombard king Liutprand. So when Pope Gregory III fell out with Liutprand in 738, he appealed to Charles Martel for help. The argument began with the Duke of Spoleto, who defied an order given by the Lombard king and then fled to Rome for sanctuary. When the Pope refused to hand him over to the king, Liutprand expressed his displeasure by taking back bits of the brand new papal state and occupying them himself. Cut off from Constantinople, Gregory had no one else to help him, and so he sent a desperate message to Martel. "In our great affliction, we have thought it necessary to write to you," Gregory began. "We can now no longer endure the persecution of the Lombards. You, O son, will receive favor from the same Prince of Apostles here and in the future life, in the presence of God, according as you render speedy aid to his church and to us, that all peoples may recognize the faith and love and singleness of purpose which you display in defending St. Peter and us and his chosen people. For by doing this you will attain lasting fame on earth and eternal life in heaven." The letter earns Gregory III partial credit for first articulating one of the goals that would motivate later crusaders, salvation, offered to those who fought in the name of the Church. Unfortunately, it didn't work with Charles Martel. The Dux et Princeps Francorum sent a present back to Gregory but declined to get involved. He and Liutprand had fought side by side at least once, and making enemies of the Lombards would gain him absolutely nothing. Apparently, he wasn't convinced by Gregory's redemptive rhetoric. The standoff in Italy dragged on for several more years, and was finally resolved by the death of everyone involved. Charles Martel and Pope Gregory III died in 741, and Liutprand died in 744, after an astounding 32 years as King of the Lombards. It had been a relatively minor political tangle, but Gregory's appeal to Charles Martel had revealed a shift in the landscape. In a universe where the protection of the Byzantine Emperor had been whisked away, the bishops of Rome were on their own, forced to make alliances with whatever power might be willing to protect them. In 751, even the nominal claim of the emperor to rule in Italy was destroyed. The Lombards captured Ravenna under the guidance of the aggressive new Lombard king Aistulf and took the last exarch captive. A few patches of Italian land remained loyal to the emperor. The city of Venice, notably, declared itself Byzantine, but now there was no Byzantine government on the peninsula. Constantinople had no representative. Venice and the other Byzantine cities were forced to govern themselves, and the Pope was entirely on his own. Unlike Charles Martel, though, the new Dux et Princeps Francorum was willing to protect Rome from hostile Lombards, in return for a favour. After Charles Martel's death, his two sons, Carloman and Pippin the Younger, had inherited his power, Carloman as mayor of the palace in Austrasia and Pippin the Younger in Neustria. The brothers had decided to put a figurehead king on the Frankish throne, which had been empty for 7 years. Their choice was Childeric III. He was the son of the previous king, but his lineage was irrelevant, since he took no part in governing. Neither, after a few years, did Carloman. In 747, at the age of 40, he left his wife and children in the care of his younger brother, and went to Rome to be consecrated as a monk. It was the culmination of a lifelong dream. Despite his years in the mayor's palace at Neustria, he had, as Fredegar tells us, a burning for the contemplative life. According to Charlemagne's biographer Einhard, Carloman tried to live in a monastery near Rome, but was continually disturbed by Frankish noblemen coming to visit him. So shortly after his consecration, he travelled to Monte Cassino, to the monastery established by Benedict himself, where the rules of silence and isolation were strictly observed. There, Einhard writes, he passed in the religious life what remained of his earthly existence. This left Pippin the Younger as sole mayor, and in 751 he decided to remove Childeric III and claim the throne himself. Yet that lingering regard for royal blood caused him to search for a greater sanction than himself for his usurpation of the throne. And so he sent two men south to Rome with a brief message for the Pope, Gregory III's successor, Zachary. The official chronicles of the Frankish kings, Annales Regni Francorum, give us a terse account. They were sent to Pope Zachary to ask whether it was good that, at that time, there were kings in Francia who had no royal power. Pope Zachary informed Pippin that it was better for him who had the royal power to be called king than the one who remained without royal power. By means of his apostolic authority, so that order might not be cast into confusion, he decreed that Pippin should be made king. Zachary, facing the hostile Aistulf, was willing to trade the church's approval for protection from the Lombards. Pippin ordered Childeric III tonsured and sent to a monastery, where he died 5 years later, the last of the Merovingians. Pippin was crowned the first king of the Carolingian dynasty in the city of Soissons, in a brand new sacred ceremony that involved anointing with holy oil, in the manner of an Old Testament theocratic king. Author's note, the Carolingian dynasty took its name from Carolus, the Latin form of Charles Martel's name. Zachary died in 752, but his successor, Pope Stephen II, was careful to put himself in a position to reap the benefits of that coronation. In 754, he travelled north into the lands of the Franks and re-anointed Pippin in an even more elaborate ceremony, which also included the anointing of his sons, 7-year-old Charles and 3-year-old Carloman, as his heirs. At the same time, according to an anonymous addition to Gregory of Tours' History of the Franks, he bound all the Frankish princes, on pain of interdict and excommunication, never to presume in future to elect a king begotten by any men, except those confirmed and consecrated by the most blessed pontiff. Author's note, excommunication blocked a single person from taking part in the sacraments of the church. Interdict blocked an entire community. When the church declared an interdict over a country or province, no one within it could receive a sacrament and all public worship was halted. He had tied the Frankish king's power to the authority of the Pope, and King Pippin responded by marching across the Alps down into Italy, driving Aistulf out of the papal lands and the lands once governed by the Exarch, and giving all of them to the Pope. Aistulf's army was badly defeated, and he was forced to recognize Pippin as his overlord. After Aistulf was thrown from his horse while hunting and died in 756, Pippin chose the Lombard nobleman Desiderius to be the next king of Italy. In half a decade, he had become not only king of the Franks, but the de facto ruler of Italy as well. Pope Stephen II didn't do badly either. He now ruled over a much expanded papal kingdom, which included both Rome and the old imperial centre of Ravenna. To justify his possession of these lands, he presented Pippin with a document that, he claimed, had been written by Constantine and had been in the possession of the church ever since. In it, Constantine explained that the 4th-century Pope Sylvester had healed him of a secret case of leprosy. In gratitude, he decreed that the papal seat shall be more gloriously exalted than our empire and earthly throne, that the Pope would henceforth be supreme over the 4 chief seats of the Church, Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Jerusalem, as also over all the churches of God in the whole world, and that Constantine himself was handing over to the Pope the city of Rome and all the provinces, districts, and cities of Italy. We are relinquishing them by our inviolable gift to the power and sway of himself and his successors. This document had been forged by some talented cleric, and the ink on it was barely dry. Pippin, who was not an idiot, undoubtedly knew this, but the popes had given him the authority he craved, and in return he was willing to award them power over Rome and the surrounding lands. The forgery, known as the Donation of Constantine, gave the transfer of authority a spurious sort of legitimacy. But as long as no one examined it closely, spurious legitimacy served the purposes of everyone involved perfectly well. 5 years after Al-Andalus became entirely independent from Baghdad, King Pippin of the Franks died. He left his crown jointly to his sons Charles, now 21, and Carloman, 18. Author's note, the birth year of Charles, Charlemagne, is not known for certain. It has traditionally been listed as 742, but more likely was 747 or 748. Both young men had been anointed along with him in 754, and so could claim to rule with the approval of God. They divided the administration of the empire, although not along the traditional Neustrian-Austrasian lines. Instead, Charles ruled the northern lands and the coast, and Carloman took control of the southern territories. 2 years after his accession, Charles married the daughter of Desiderius, the king of the Lombards, whose accession Pippin had supervised. "Nobody knows why," writes Einhard, "but he dismissed this wife after 1 year. In her place, he married an Alemanni girl named Hildegard, who was only 13 years old. This gave him a useful connection with the eastern region of his empire, where the sometimes troublesome Alemanni people lived. Naturally, it infuriated the Lombard king, who proposed to Carloman that they unite together to destroy Charles, but in 771, just as the plan was being formed, Carloman died. Charles now ruled as sole monarch of all the Frankish lands. Almost at once, he began to enlarge it through conquest. In 772, he set off to fight against the Saxons, just across the Rhine River. He was not yet thinking about the south, where the Lombard king Desiderius was still planning an attack. First, Charles wanted to expand his empire to the north. The land around the Rhine was rich, and the Saxon tribes were not well united. They fell into three main divisions: the central Saxons on the Weser River, the Eastphalians on the Elbe, and the Westphalians closer to the coast, but rarely fought together. Charles pushed into the Saxon land in 772, and beat his way through the disorganized Saxon resistance into the Teutoburg forest, where he ordered his men to destroy the most sacred shrine of the Saxons, the Irminsul, a great wooden pillar representing a tree trunk, which symbolized the sacred tree that supported the vault of the heavens. He intended to show the Saxons that, as the God-appointed Christian king, he dominated both the Saxons and their gods, but the destruction of the Irminsul would haunt him. The Saxons were not politically united enough to mount a strong defense, but they held a single set of religious beliefs, and for decades to come, the destruction of the Irminsul remained in their memories. Leaving the Saxons temporarily subdued, Charles returned home and prepared to march into Italy. The following year he crossed the Alps, set on punishing Desiderius for his plots and aiming to claim Italy for his own. Desiderius and the Lombard army met him in the north of Italy, but Charles pushed the Lombard king back into his capital city of Pavia and laid siege to it. The siege lasted nearly a year. Charles, in the words of his biographer, did not stop until he had worn Desiderius down and had received his surrender. Rather than executing Desiderius, Charles imprisoned him in a monastery in northern Francia. Desiderius's son and heir fled to Constantinople, where he took refuge at the imperial court. Charles, at 27, was now the king of all the Franks and Lombard Italy as well. In 774, he claimed the traditional iron crown of the Lombards, so called because the Lombards believed that the iron band inside it was beaten from one of the nails from Christ's cross, and the Lombard kingdom ceased to exist. It was the first of the great empire-expanding victories that would earn him the name Charles the Great, or Charlemagne. Exalted by his victories in the northeast and southeast, Charlemagne then set his sights on the southwest. Abd al-Rahman's seizure of the Emirate of Cordoba had not sat well with all of the Muslims in Al-Andalus. In 778, a group of dissidents in the northeastern part of Al-Andalus, led by the chief administrator of the region, Suleiman al-Arabi, invited Charlemagne to help them get rid of the Umayyad rule. They promised him that the city of Zaragoza, well inside the borders of the emirate, would open its gates and welcome him in so that he could use it as his base of operations. This must have seemed like a good idea, but it ended in disaster. Charlemagne marched to Zaragoza with his men, visions of conquering Al-Andalus in his head. When he arrived at its walls, however, the governor of the city, who had up until this point been in alliance with Suleiman and the dissidents, changed his mind and refused to let him in. Charlemagne camped outside the walls for weeks, but the gates never swung open. Without a walled city to protect him, he was finally forced to withdraw back through the Pyrenees. He was furious, and on the way home he sacked the fortress of Pamplona as he passed it. This, like his destruction of the Irminsul, was a miscalculation. Pamplona was not firmly in the control of the Emir of Cordoba. It was instead the home of the Vascones, a tribe that had been in Hispania before the Romans arrived, and had survived in the mountains through the Roman occupation, the Visigoth takeover, and the arrival of the Arabs. Author's note, the Vascones were probably the ancestors of the present-day Basque people, who still live in the same mountain region. They were tough, independent, and resourceful, and they took vengeance on Charlemagne as he went back through the mountains towards his own kingdom. At the pass of Roncesvalles, the Vascones attacked the end of the Frankish column, wiping out the baggage train and killing the rear guard to the last man. They were lightly armed and experienced in the mountains, and after the slaughter they disappeared into the rough terrain. The Franks, weighed down by their own weapons and armor, were unable to pursue them. The ambush was disproportionately devastating to Charlemagne, because a number of his officers and personal friends were in the rear when the Vascones descended. Among them was a man whom Einhard calls Roland, Lord of the Breton Marches, the nobleman who governed the Frankish territory on the western coast, just above the mouth of the Loire. Stories were told about the minor ambush until it had been transformed into a pivotal battle. Roland became the hero of the first French epic, the 12th century Song of Roland, which turns the bloody incident into a major conspiracy between the Arabs of Zaragoza and a traitor within Charlemagne's own camp. In the epic, 20,000 Arabs descend on the rear of the Frankish army, and Roland refuses to blow his horn for help until he has fought to the end of his strength. When he finally does blow the horn, Charlemagne rides back from the front of the column to help, but the force of the horn's sound has shattered the bones of Roland's skull. Charlemagne then takes vengeance on the Arabs with the help of God. For Charlemagne a great marvel God planned, making the sun still in his course to stand. So pagans fled, and chased them well, the Franks, through the valley of shadows close in hand, towards Saragusse, by force they chased them back, and as they went, with killing blows attacked. But in reality the Battle of Roncesvalles ended Charlemagne's ambitions in Al-Andalus. He never pushed his way past the Pyrenees again. Chapter 50. The An-Lushan Rebellion. Between 751 and 779, the brilliant emperor falls in love with his son's wife, and loses her, along with his throne. When Gen Xianji arrived back home after the Battle of Talas, he discovered that his emperor was in trouble. Tang Xuanzong had been on the throne for 40 years, leading the Tang into the most brilliant era of its existence. The empire was at the very height of its power and size. The arts flourished. Tang porcelain, as clear and thin as glass, was prized by every country that bought goods from the trade route that stretched from China toward the west, the Silk Road. The Tang painter Wu Daozi created portraits and murals so breathtaking that he was rumored to have opened a painted door in one of his landscapes and stepped through. Tang poets composed verses that would endure for centuries. Li Bai, whose reputation had spread empire-wide, wrote in the new regulated style, orderly and metered. Cut water with a sword, the water flows on. Quench sorrow with wine, the sorrow increases. In our lifetime, our wishes are unfulfilled. Wang Wei, poet and painter, wrote Jueju, cut short quatrains that glanced at a truth and then away, leaving the reader to seek the deeper meaning. A morning shower in Wecheng has settled the light dust. The willows by the hostel are fresh and green. Come, drink one more cup of wine. West of the pass you will meet no more old friends. But the flower of the arts at court could not disguise the rot at its roots. The brilliant emperor, now nearing 70, had become obsessed with his son's young wife, Yang Guifei. He had forced his son to divorce her and had taken her for his own consort. Her cousin, the official Yang Guozhong, had been given more and more power at court through her influence. She was fond, perhaps overly fond, of the army officer An Lushan, and the brilliant emperor pliantly awarded An Lushan greater and greater authority. He had dismissed his chancellor, Zhang Juling, a man who had gained his position through examination. He was famous for his wisdom, his asceticism, and his stern moral compass. He once gave the emperor advice, rather than a present, for his birthday, and in his place had appointed the dictatorial privileged aristocrat Li Linfu. And the expansion of the empire had not come without cost. Resentment was building over the extensive military campaigns that the brilliant emperor ordered. "White bones are the only crop in these yellow sands," wrote Li Bai, after one protracted war against the northern barbarians. "There seems no end to the fighting. In the wilderness men hack one another to pieces, riderless horses neigh madly to the sky. The blood of soldiers smears grass and brambles. What use is a commander without his troops? War is a fearful thing, and the wise prince resorts to it only if he must." The emperor's growing preoccupation with his personal life meant that the generals on the frontiers took more and more authority themselves, even as wars multiplied. In 751, while Gao Xianji was struggling with the Arabs to the far west, the Khitan invaded the north once again, and a year-long struggle to drive them out began. The peace with Tibet disintegrated, and Tibetan attacks and raids on the Central Asian frontier intensified. At the end of that same year, a southwestern tributary kingdom of the Tang rebelled. The Nan Zhao kingdom had coalesced in the land around Lake Erhai, out of six tribes known to the Chinese as the Bai. As with so many other newborn nations, this one could trace its existence back to the conquering instincts of a single personality, the Bai chief, Piloge. 20 years early, Piloge had not only claimed the rulership of all six tribes, but also burnt the chiefs of the other tribes alive. His rise had been so meteoric that, barely a decade after seizing power, he had managed to make a match between his grandson and a princess of Tang descent. The brilliant emperor had seen Piloge's strengthening domain as a useful buffer between the Tang border and the hostile soldiers of Tibet, and had bestowed a title on Piloge. He even invited the new king and his grandson to come and celebrate the marriage in Chang'an itself. But Piloge's successor, Geluo Feng, now took advantage of the weakness he saw in the Tang and went on the attack. The Tang governor of the Southwest Territory sent an army to respond, but Geluo Feng and the Bai army handed them an unexpected and embarrassing defeat. A few months later, the aristocratic minister Li Linfu died, and the consort Yang Guifei used her influence to have her cousin Yang Guozhong appointed as next chancellor of the Tang. This was not a bad thing. Yang Guozhong was ambitious and not adverse to working his family connections for his own gain, but he was also loyal to his emperor. Once admitted to the inner workings of the government, he grew increasingly worried about his cousin's marked preference for the general, An Lushan. In his opinion, An Lushan was not only ambitious but unprincipled, and he feared that the general was plotting against the throne. In 754, a second victory by the Nan Zhao gave the general An Lushan his chance. A large Tang force under another general had been sent south to punish Geluo Feng for daring to defeat the southwest border force, but at the Battle of Xiaoguan, the Tang army was massacred. Almost all of the survivors were killed by plague as they limped home. It was said that 200,000 soldiers died fighting the small southern kingdom, and this merely heightened the anger and discontent of an army that had already been embarrassed by the defeat at the Battle of Talas 3 years before. In 755, An Lushan declared himself an open rival to the brilliant emperor, with a royal capital of his own at Fanyang, the northern military garrison where his command had been centered for some years. He commanded over 100,000 men, a mixture of well-trained soldiers and northern horsemen recruited from the Khitan. They followed him south along the Yellow River to the fortress at Luoyang, a center of administration for the east of the empire, which they captured without difficulty. Here, An Lushan lingered, resting his army and preparing for an attack on Chang'an itself. The brilliant emperor was furious. He gave Gao Xianji, commander at the Battle of Talas, the task of campaigning against An Lushan, and then, when the veteran general did not meet with quick success, had him beheaded. In order to pacify the emperor, the loyal chancellor Yang Guozhong then planned an enormous frontal assault against the advice of military advisers, who recommended circling the rebel forces cutting them off from the supplies and reinforcements coming from Fanyang and waiting them out. In the summer heat of July 756, 6 months after the fall of Luoyang, the Tang Royal Army marched to meet the rebels and was destroyed. 180,000 men fell, leaving no one to defend Chang'an itself. The brilliant emperor and the chancellor fled to the west. 10 days after the battle, An Lushan arrived at the walls of the capital and occupied it, almost unopposed. On the road into exile, the brilliant emperor's royal guard turned on the chancellor. They blamed him for the disaster, and despite the emperor's objections, they surrounded him and murdered both Yang Guozhong and his son. Then they demanded that the brilliant emperor hand over his consort, the beautiful Yang Guifei, for execution. She had helped Yang Guozhong rise to power in their eyes. Her partiality, both for her cousin and for the rebellious An Lushan, had helped bring Tang power down. The emperor stalled, objected, refused, and then finally realized that he had no choice. Rather than handing her over to the angry soldiers, he ordered one of his loyal court eunuchs to kill her quickly. His grief was made famous half a century later by the poet Bai Zhuyi. Covering his face with his hands, he could not save her. Turning back to look at her, his tears mingled with her blood. Yellow dust filled the sky. The wind was cold and shrill. Heaven and earth may not last forever, but this sorrow was eternal. The brilliant emperor retreated to the southern city of Chengdu, mourning all the way. The An Lushan rebellion ended badly for both the brilliant emperor and for the rebel An Lushan. The emperor's son, Su Zong, the heir apparent, forced the old, broken emperor to abdicate in 756 and claim the throne in exile himself. Meanwhile, in Chang'an, An Lushan had declared himself the Emperor Yan, but he had contracted some disease that caused him to suffer from large and excruciatingly painful boils on his face, and he was growing increasingly short-tempered and paranoid. After months of unpredictable and cruel behavior, he was murdered in the middle of the night in 757 by one of his house servants. An Lushan's son picked up his banner, but Tang Su Zong managed to re-enter Chang'an with his own soldiers later in the same year and drive the remaining rebels out. This didn't end the fighting, though. Resistance continued for the next 6 years in a long, drawn-out series of inconclusive battles. Tang Su Zong died of a heart attack in 762, and his son, Tang Dai Zong, finally managed, in 763, to put down the last remnants of the An Lushan rebellion. But the internationally feared power of the Tang was broken. Almost all of the border guard had been recalled to fight on one side or the other of the civil war, and the frontiers of the empire had begun to crumble. In late 763, while the new emperor Tang Dai Zong and his general were in Luoyang mopping up the remnants of rebellion there, Tibetan troops whirled all the way into Chang'an and looted it before withdrawing. For the next decade, Tibetan attacks from the southwest would be an annual event. To the north and northwest, the Tang border suffered just as badly from the incursions of Uyghur tribes. The Uyghurs had been a vassal tribe of the eastern Turkish Khaganate, but they had broken away from their overlords and established their own kingdom with its capital at Ordu Balik. Both Tang Su Zong and his son Tang Dai Zong had hired Uyghur mercenaries to help fight against the rebels, and the heavy payments that the emperors handed over had boosted Uyghur wealth. The mercenaries had taken some knowledge of Chinese writing back home with them, along with loot stolen from both Chang'an and Luoyang, and this became the basis of an Uyghur writing system. The imported culture sparked a transformation that gradually turned the tribes of warrior nomads into a more stable kingdom. To the northeast, the Korean kingdom of Unified Silla, which now dominated most of the peninsula under the rule of King Yongdeok, felt the sting of the Tang civil war. The kings of Silla had gained their unified empire with the help of Tang forces, and they needed Tang support because their power over the peninsula was not unchallenged. Survivors of the destroyed Korean kingdom of Goguryeo had gathered in the north, where they had settled and intermarried with the semi-nomadic tribes of the Malgal, and formed a new kingdom called Balhae. In the aftermath of the An Lushan rebellion, the Balhae king Mun took advantage of the lessened Tang presence to conquer the surrounding territory, until Balhae had grown even larger than unified Silla to its south. With so much fighting going on at the borders, the population of the Tang Empire shifted away from the north and west towards the central and southern lands. The ancient cities of the north fell into decline. By the time Tang Dai Zong died in 779, The Tang had lost all of its holdings in Central Asia. The trade routes to the west had been disrupted and blocked. The generals who were tasked with protecting the shrunken outer reaches of the empire gained more and more power. Neither the Tang Emperor nor his ministers were able to check their growing independence. The surrounding peoples, Tibet, Nanzhao, the Uyghurs, Balhae, Unified Silla, had shifted and changed. The Anlushan Rebellion had reshaped not just Tang China, but the entire landscape of the continent. Chapter 51. Imperator et Augustus. Between 775 and 802, the Empress Irene seizes power in Constantinople, while Charlemagne conquers his neighbours for Christ's kingdom and allows himself to be crowned as emperor. In three decades on the Byzantine throne, Constantine V had presided over the ongoing quarrels between icon lovers and icon haters. He had seen the end of the Umayyad Caliphate and the beginning of the Abbasid rule. He had watched Byzantine rule in Italy fail, and Rome finally slip from the grasp of Constantinople. He had heard news of the crowning of Pippin the Younger as the first Carolingian king, and the rise of Charlemagne's power. He had married a Khazar wife, and been troubled by the raids of Avars and the invasions of Arab armies. In 775, the 34th year of his reign, he began to plan a war against the First Bulgarian Empire. The Bulgarians had been more or less allies of Byzantium since Tervel and his men had helped Leo III lift the siege of Constantinople back in 718, but Constantine V's habit of settling captive peoples, mostly from his battles with the Arabs in Thracia, crowding the Bulgarian borders, had annoyed the Bulgarian Khans. In retaliation, Bulgarian troops had begun to raid Byzantine land. Constantine V decided that the Bulgarians needed to be put in their place, but in September, as he was preparing to start out on his anti-Bulgarian campaign, he fell ill with what Theophanes describes as an overpowering inflammation in his legs that caused severe fever. He died on the 14th day of the month, screaming that he was burning alive. For a time, the plan to invade Bulgaria dropped into oblivion. Constantine V was succeeded by his half-Khazar son Leo IV, who abandoned the Bulgarian project in order to secure his throne. He had five half-brothers, the sons of his father's third marriage, who were threats to his power, and immediately after taking the throne he was forced to exile two of them when he discovered that they were at the center of a conspiracy to remove him from the throne. Then he began to plan an attack against the Arabs in Syria, which he saw as more urgent than the Bulgarian campaign. He never sent his troops into war, though. He died in 780, after only 5 years on the throne, and his nine-year-old son became the Emperor Constantine VI, The little boy's mother served as his regent. Her name was Irene, like a Khazar mother-in-law, but she was from an old Athenian family. The youth of the emperor and the regency of a woman in Constantinople struck the new Abbasid caliph, Al-Mandi, son of Al-Mansur, as a fatal weakness in the empire. He launched a new offensive into Asia Minor and drove the Byzantine defenders away in record time, sweeping all the way to the Bosphorus Strait and setting up a camp at the port city of Chrysopolis, right across the water from Constantinople. This was embarrassing for the regent Irene, who had to pay him an enormous ransom and agree to a yearly tribute in order to get him to withdraw. Perhaps feeling the need for a strong alliance to back her up, in 782 she sent two messengers all the way across to the kingdom of the Franks and asked Charlemagne to betroth one of his daughters to the 11-year-old emperor. Charlemagne could easily think of himself, at this point, as equal in stature to the regent of Constantinople. He controlled the lands of the Franks and Italians, and he was creating a dynasty. He had crowned his third son, Pippin, as king of Italy, his fourth son, Louis the Pious, as king of the Frankish territory Aquitaine, and he ruled over them as an emperor rules over vassal kings. Author's note, Charlemagne's oldest son, Pippin the Hunchback, had quarreled with his father and been disinherited, and Charlemagne then renamed his third son, Carloman, Pippin, so that he would still have a Pippin in the family line. His second son, Charles the Younger, had been designated to inherit the job of King of the Franks. Charlemagne had taken on the responsibility of protecting and defining the Papal States. The Pope's land now stretched from Rome in a band across Italy, encompassing Rome, Sutri, and the old Byzantine lands once governed from Ravenna, which made him defender of the Christian faith. He was the most powerful king in the West, and also the king with the strongest sense of Christian mission in his empire building. An alliance between the Carolingians and the Byzantine emperors would create not only a united front against the Arabs, but an empire of the spirit, a Western mirror for the Eastern Empire, a Christian counterpart to the ever-advancing Islamic kingdom. Charlemagne also had plenty of daughters to make useful alliances with, and a lot of sons. In his long life he had 4 wives, 6 additional consorts, and 20 children, and he agreed to marry his 3rd oldest daughter, Rotrude, to Constantine VI. The little girl was 8 years old, so the betrothal took place in name only while both children remained with their parents. Theoretically, the marriage could have become reality when Rotrude reached adolescence, which in the 8th century was fairly loosely defined. Certainly when Constantine VI turned 16 in 787, he could have asked for the 13-year-old Rotrude to be sent to him, but instead his mother Irene broke off the engagement. Her position was more secure now, and she no longer needed alliance with the Frankish king. In fact, Charlemagne's growing power threatened the remaining enclaves of Byzantine-loyal land on the Italian peninsula. The broken engagement was an insult to Charlemagne, who had been growing not just in power, but also in his role as Christian king. The days of the mayor of the palace, reluctant to lay full hold of royal power, were long past. Charlemagne had gathered around him a royal circle of scholars and clerics who were filling in the gaps from his early education. He had received from his father much more military training than book learning, and had never learned to write. They not only discussed with him the finer points of theology, philosophy, and grammar, but also called him King David, after the Old Testament monarch who was handpicked by God to lead the chosen people. Author's note: Charlemagne's intellectual curiosity and his personal tutor's teaching combined to spark a revival of learning often called the Carolingian Renaissance. Innovations in art, music, architecture, and calligraphy can be traced back to their beginnings under Charlemagne's sponsorship. Under the guidance of his personal tutor, Alcuin, a British churchman whom Charlemagne had recruited to teach his sons, the King of the Franks developed a stronger and stronger sense of mission. His conquests were, in his own eyes, forceful evangelism, bringing the gospel to stubborn unbelievers who needed to be saved not just from their sins, but from their own unwillingness to hear. Earlier in the decade, he had concluded a campaign against the Saxons with exactly this sort of persuasion. The Saxon resistance to his rule and the Saxon toll on his army had so angered him that in 782 he had ordered 4,500 Saxon prisoners to be massacred. Their leader, Widukind, had escaped, but after 3 years on the run, he had finally been forced to surrender. As part of his surrender, Widukind had to agree to Christian baptism. And afterward, Charlemagne decreed that any unbaptized Saxon who conceals himself among his people and refuses to seek baptism, but rather chooses to remain a pagan, shall die. A Saxon who stole from a church, or did violence to a priest, or indulged himself in the old Saxon rites instead of Christian worship, would be put to death, and any Saxon who did not observe Lent properly would be executed. Alcuin objected. "Abate a little of your threatening," he told the king, "and do not force them by public compulsion until faith has thoroughly grown in their hearts." Charlemagne considered the argument and agreed, revoking the death penalty. This did not change his sense of duty. He was bringing not merely salvation, but right doctrine and practice to the Western world. Irene of Byzantium did not see Charlemagne as the king of the Christian West. As far as she was concerned, she held the highest God-sanctioned authority in the known world. After she broke Constantine VI's engagement, she refused to yield the throne to her son, even though he was old enough to rule in his own name. She named herself not just regent, but empress. And on that authority, she summoned a church council, the Second Council of Nicaea, to reverse all of the icon-condemning pronouncements made during the reigns of Leo III and his successors. Irene struggled for 3 years to reign as empress, but too many of the men in Constantinople resented her usurpation, and in 790 the army forced her to hand over authority to Constantine VI. Unfortunately, the rightful emperor turned out to be weak, sadistic, and incompetent. In 791 he set out on the Bulgarian campaign that his grandfather had planned, and was twice defeated by the Bulgarian Khan Kardam. "He joined battle without calculation or order," Theophanes writes, "and was severely defeated. He fled back to the city after losing many men. The imperial guard, deciding that it had made a mistake, began to plan a revolt that would put Constantine VI's uncle, Nikephoros, one of the half-brothers who had been involved in the conspiracy against Constantine's own father, on the throne instead. Like his father, Constantine VI discovered the plot. Unlike his father, he did not show mercy by exiling the conspirators. Instead, he had all five of his uncles arrested and brought to court. He blinded Nikephoros, who probably had not even been centrally involved in the conspiracy, and, in an act of completely gratuitous cruelty, cut the tongues out of the other four brothers. Then he blundered back into conflict with the Bulgarians. This time the Khan Kardam threatened to invade Thracia unless Constantine VI paid him tribute. The emperor put horse turds into a towel, Theophanes writes, and sent him this message: I have sent you such tribute as is appropriate for you. After insulting Kardam, he lost his nerve. When the Bulgarian Khan approached at the head of his army, Constantine VI went out to meet him and agreed to send him tribute after all. This was too much for the army, and Irene was able to talk the officials and chief officers at court into a plot against her son. On a June morning in 797, Constantine VI was leaving the Hippodrome after watching a horse race, when he saw palace guards approaching him. He knew at once that they were coming to overpower him. He ran through the streets of the city, down to the port, and escaped on board one of his warships, but his companions on board were in the pay of his mother. They brought him back to the city, led him into the palace, and shut him in the imperial chamber where he had been born, the purple room, reserved for the lying in of empresses. By the will of his mother and her advisers, Theophanes tells us, at around the ninth hour he was terribly and incurably blinded with the intention of killing him. In this way, his mother Irene took power. As far as Charlemagne was concerned, the throne of Constantinople was now empty. Irene was a woman, she had no legitimate claim to the Byzantine throne. Also Charlemagne, with his passion for correct doctrine, found Irene's support for icons unacceptable. Although the Pope had assured him that icons were not graven images, he was not convinced. He even put together a theological committee of his own to study the report of the Second Council of Nicaea and write a rebuttal. The rebuttal, called the Libri Carolini, was sent to Rome, where the Pope apparently ignored it. In his eyes, Irene was not only female and a usurper, but also an idol worshipper. At the same time, Charlemagne was receiving constant proofs of his own high status among the kingdoms of the West. In 798, the ruler of Asturias, the Christian kingdom in the mountains north of Al-Andalus, sent him a formal embassy that requested his recognition for the legitimacy of the king. Since its beginnings in 718 as a tiny and poverty-stricken realm of resistance to Muslim rule, Asturias had grown. The Asturian king, Alfonso II, now ruled over a realm that included the neighbouring city of León and the land along the coast, all the way down to the city of Lisbon. Alfonso II wanted recognition from Charlemagne, the greatest Christian king of the West, for the legitimacy of his own throne. Charlemagne, never doubting that such an assurance was in his power, gave it. The following year he was asked to carry out an even more imperial duty. Pope Leo III, who had occupied the papal throne in Rome since 795, had run into trouble. He was not terribly popular in Rome, either because he was not an aristocrat or because he was immoral and dishonest. No proof for the latter accusation survives, so it is difficult to trace the roots of the enmity. For whatever reason, the hostility swelled in Rome until, in 799, a band of his enemies attacked him in the middle of a sacred procession and tried to cut out his eyes and tongue. Unlike the unfortunate Nikephoros, who had received the same treatment over in Constantinople, Leo III managed to escape with cuts on his face, but with his eyes and tongue intact. He fled to Charlemagne, who was with his royal court at the city of Paderborn, just south of the Rhine, and asked the king to help him drive his enemies from the city. At Leo's consecration as pope, Charlemagne had promised to defend him. My task, assisted by the divine piety, is everywhere to defend the Church of Christ, he had written to Leo, abroad, by arms, against pagan incursions and the devastations of such as break faith. At home, by protecting the Church in the spreading of the Catholic faith. He had not envisioned defending the Church at home with arms, which was what Leo needed. And the situation was complicated by the fact that most of his Frankish officials believed that the charges were true. But whether or not Leo was guilty was almost a side issue. The position of the Bishop of Rome had to be unassailable. If the Pope spoke for God, he could not be removed by the same sorts of earthly machinations that had brought Constantine VI to a wretched end. Yet in order to protect the office of the papacy from becoming another throne to be contested and won by force, Charlemagne would have to exercise force on its behalf. He delayed taking action, thinking the problem through. Ultimately, it seems his advisor Alcuin swayed his mind, pointing out that Charlemagne was now the only remaining representative of God in the known world who still had any power to right wrongs. There have hitherto been three persons of great eminence in the world, namely the Pope, who rules the See of Peter, and you have kindly informed me what has happened to him. The second is the Emperor who holds sway over the second Rome, and common report has now made known how wickedly the governor of such an empire has been deposed. The third is the throne on which our Lord Jesus Christ has placed you to rule over our Christian people, with greater power, clearer insight, and more exalted royalty than the aforementioned dignitaries. On you alone the whole safety of the churches of Christ depends. As the last protector of the church, Charlemagne's duty was clear. So, in 800, Charlemagne sent the Pope home to Rome with an armed bodyguard. He followed, marching in full martial array, with his army into the city. When he arrived, Leo put his hand on the copy of the Gospels in St. Peter's Cathedral and swore, in the presence of onlookers, that he was guiltless of any wrongdoing. With Charlemagne and his soldiers standing by, the oath was effective. Charlemagne lingered in the city until Christmas Day. He went to morning mass, knelt for prayers, and as he began to get to his feet, Leo III came forward and put a gold crown on his head. The crowd, which had been coached, cheered. Long life and victory to Charles, the most pious Augustus, the great peace-loving emperor crowned by God. He had been crowned Imperator et Augustus, two titles that belonged to the Emperor of Rome, titles that, in the eyes of the Byzantine court, had long ago been transferred to Constantinople. But in the eyes of Charlemagne, the title of emperor had been unclaimed until his coronation. The official description of the event, written afterwards by a Frankish cleric, explains, when, in the land of the Greeks, there was